Good evening. Lovely to see you all. Are any of you impatient? Hands up, anyone who would say they're impatient. Yeah? There was an article yesterday, and it goes like this. It is said that patience is a virtue, but it could also lead to a longer life, a study suggests. Intriguing research has found that impatient people are aging prematurely, and the desire to get things moving could be linked to the fact that their life really is slipping away. The findings lead to the possibility that impatient and anxious people could slow down their aging process with interventions like meditation. So if you are impatient and you're not meditating, that might be a good idea. As I said in previous weeks, that when you do a course like this, all sorts of things appear. There's an exhibition in Cambridge, which is called Death on the Nile, all about the Egyptians' view on death. So if you fancy a trip to lovely Cambridge, that is also on the agenda. Right. Who wasn't here last week? Okay. There were some things printed out. I haven't been able to do all of them, but there are some quite important diagrams. I think that we printed out 10 of them there when we began our journey into the subtle world. And we are going to use a certain kind of terminology which is in those diagrams. Hopefully you'll listen to that fourth week recording and you'll get a sense of what we're talking about. But in terms of our future discussion, it's quite important that you get used to some of this terminology, otherwise you won't know what on earth is going on. So, for instance, we talk about the Atman as the real self. We talked about the Antakarana, which is Anta being inner, Karana being instrument. So this is the inner organ of mind, the Antakarana. And then the Antakarana consisted of four aspects, which were the Buddhi, the Ahankara, the Manas, and the Chitta. So we will be using this terminology. We also talked about the guna. What on earth are they? Well, if you listen to the recording, you'll have some sense of that. So if you could just make sure that you listen to that recording, because although we're still in the subtle world and will be this week and next week, we'll be then entering the spiritual world, which will be fun. And then this terminology will be more and more useful to us. So that's the diagram, one of the diagrams, just to give you an idea. So we're in week 5, and the subject for today is time. And luckily, I don't have to do any of the work today. I can sit back and listen to this wisdom from my colleagues. It's worth thinking back into your youth. Do you remember those long summer days when perhaps, I don't know, you were 4 or 5 years old, when a day felt like a month? Do you remember those kind of days? It's as if that day was going to go on forever. Well, summer days are longer in any case, aren't they? But do you feel that now that you're older? Do you still have that sense, that quality? Belinda over there still does. Excellent. Well done. Most people would say, not really. It's not quite like that anymore. In fact, as you get older, life seems to rush by, doesn't it? Yeah, the days, the months, the years go by. Suddenly you find there's this thing called middle age. Oh my God. And then you suddenly find that there's something called old age. So it's a perception of time. So one of the issues I'm sure my colleagues is going to bring up today is, what is our perception of time? What does it feel like? We know, for instance, when people often say in an accident or a time of crisis, there are many descriptions where people say the opposite. They say time suddenly slows down. There's many, many recordings of this. So the perception of time completely slows down. People say it all happened in slow motion. It was like a movie. So that's a different perception of time. What is time? Is there such a thing as time? Is it just a mental construct? These are big questions. So in relation to death and dying, obviously, time is very important. And we experience time in the subtle world. And that experience, as I say, will vary. So just a brief, before Peter starts, he's going to take the first half. Martin passed this on to me. So what we're going to be looking at tonight is a brief overview of how physics views time, the concept of eternity in cosmology and psychology, the role of time and memory in our illusion of time, and finally the idea of the present moment, the eternal now, as an alternative to linear eternity. And as you know, I've been going on and on about the here and now. So where does that here and now stand in terms of this linear view of time, in terms of the past and the future, which we take to be our lives and this journey from being born to dying? So where is time in all that? All right, so I can now retreat, and young Peter will now run the show. Thank you.
Okay, when I left you, you were all doing your homework. This is why I got to get close to you, to make sure that you all did your homework. Who did their homework? Well, first of all, who can remember what it was? One, two, three, four, five, six. Right, okay, that's a bit better. Now, who actually practiced it and did it? Because this is one of the most fundamental things that you can do.
Thank you. Time went more slowly, so I was able to stand back and watch rather than being in a fearful hurry the whole time.
Okay. Anybody else like to talk about what happened? You? Yes? Somebody else tell me what they noticed during their homework? Oh, guys, come on.
Yeah. It seemed quite difficult in many ways. I wasn't sure whether I was succeeding or not in keeping words and verbiage out of, you know, out of the place. And if they seemed to creep back in every now and again, I thought, were there words there or not? I wasn't quite sure.
That's very good. That's excellent. So it's the beginning of discrimination, discriminating what's going on. How many of you are meditators? Wow, then you should all be able to do this perfectly. Or perhaps you all feel that you can do it perfectly. Just to remind you that there are two systems in the brain, the default mode and the attentional system, and they play box and cox with each other. Default is up, then you're in yourself, in your memories, in the past, and then the attentional system comes up and you're present. Now, if we take that, and if you remember that I showed you that diagram of mind, and that is that if you are in yourself, then you're dead. Automatons. And how many of you have been in a car and driven for 10 miles, chatting away to yourself happily and not seeing anything? Oh yeah, you do okay on autopilot, it's all right, but you're not there. And if something grabbed the attentional system, like a bike going in front of you, you'd snap out of it very quickly. But essentially, you have not been there. So if you look at your life, and this is what Uspensky said and Gurdjieff said, they are little shining crystals strung together in a line. And those crystals are those moments when you're attentive. Now, if I was to ask you about your attentive moments, you'd all have wonderful examples. Yeah, it was a wonderful morning. I got up, and there was this tree in front of me, beautiful. And I saw the dew on the leaves, and I smelt the smell. You're alive. You're alive. So you are all dying. You're wasting your lives by not being there. All in the present. All in the past, in the future, but not in the present. So you're going to have this exercise again this week, aren't you? So how on earth are you going to do it? Well, when I was struggling with this, one of the ways that I could do it was to listen to my footfalls. In fact, I had a park I could walk across. In those days, I didn't have rubber soles, so I could hear each footfall. And if you could hear each footfall, you can see if you can remain in the present while you're walking across the park. You guys have got pavements to walk on. And you were saying that words sometimes come up, which they do. They're very seductive, and one word will trigger another, will trigger another, will trigger another, and you'll be out of it, because you will have, in fact, lost your attentional mode. You'll have gone into the default mode. And think of it as a default mode. And think of yourself as getting defaulters, if you've ever had defaulters, black marks for the length of time you spend in the default mode, because you're not there. Okay, so next week's homework is going to be the same again. Try and see what it's like to be in an attentional set. I saw lots of you are meditating. Who's going to tell me what methods of meditation they use? Mantra. Okay. Now, all those methods, you all the time just gently put yourself back on your attention, don't you? And none of you, if you're meditating, go off into long conversations, do you? Okay.
So what is not very clear to me is that even if I'm in attention mode, there are different degrees. So then I'm not sure whether I'm succeeding in the exercise or not. So maybe I'm aware that I'm in attentive mode, but it's not too attentive. It's low attention. So maybe if you ask me, maybe yeah. I've been able to do the exercise, but it was not like high level of consciousness.
Yes, that's a really nice comment. And really, the comment is the attentional mode all one level? And the answer is no, it isn't. And is the default mechanism all one level? And the answer is no, it isn't. You'll know that things like anxiety push you straight into the default mode all the time. And you'll know that attention can be very loosely held and constructed, and at other times it can be very precise and clear. So you're absolutely right. And this is one of the first things that you're beginning to learn then about how you use your attentional set. It's to try and be there and not touch it. Have you ever seen that beautiful tree? Look at that tree. And you say to yourself, oh, God, what a beautiful tree. What set are you in? You've lost it, haven't you? You're back into the default mode. So what you've got to do is just be very gentle and watch it, be present. And in fact, in one of the Zen courses that I attended, we were taught when we were doing our meditation to say on the in-breath, just, and on the out-breath, this, just this. Justice. And that's a very nice way of honing the attention as much as you can do. Okay, today we're going to do time. And time is totally fascinating. Time is great. It's terrific. And so let's just move on. Time. What is the major feature in this world that sets our time for us? Yes, it's the sun, isn't it? Whether we like it or not, it's the sun. We are creatures of the 24 hours, and you wouldn't be surprised to find that there are many, many parts of the body which respond to the 24-hour cycle. Those of you who meditate, what were you told about the 24-hour cycle? Absolutely, because things are quieter then, aren't they? For the tape, sunrise and sunset are conducive to meditation. That's absolutely correct. Absolutely. So those are two times which are important, and you can see as you go over, and it's recognized in Advaita that, in fact, this changeover, there's a lot of the sattva guna, which you were hearing about yesterday, I mean last week. And, of course, there's a lot of activity in the middle of the day. But there is, in fact, a finer underlying structure. Did any of your teachers teach you about it? Yeah.
I think it's related to the breath. There are two specific times in a day when the two nostrils sort of breathe the same.
Yes. That's true, of course. What I was thinking of is in the main time blocks. And one of the well-known Zen masters has said to meditate in the morning is gold. To meditate in the afternoon is silver, and to meditate at night is lead. So see if it's true for you. Just watch it and see how the meditation goes. And any of you meditate before you get up, or do you all get up and then meditate? Okay, it depends the sort of meditation you do, but sometimes to meditate earlier than that is great. Anyway, watch that remark and see if it holds true for you. So the main, we are creatures of the 24 hours. And of course, we always measured it by the 24 hours. In fact, the shadows, not so much here, but in the tropics, you always do. In fact, most of the kids in the tropics can, in fact, tell you what the time is just by looking at the sun. So it's a very important time, or it's a very important way that the time changes us. And of course, what we've done is we've put that into angular degrees. And that's all the clock face is. It's 360 degrees divided up twice. Do you remember at the time of the changeover of the century when people rushed out to the most east point of the time zone in order to see the sunrise first? Well, what were they getting? Because it was going to come round the world anyway, and everybody would have a first at some point. And so one of the things one learns there is that, in fact, time is artificial in that sense. We have three children. One's in England. So she's on British Summer Time, or GMT. We have one in Japan, so they're on Japanese time. We have one in America, so they're either on Daylight Standard Time or on East Coast time. And so you suddenly realize that times are absolutely, totally irrelevant, and it's a sort of construct we have. It was really before the railways came, and such a concept as railway time happened. People, in fact, had their own times. Every town had its own time. And so we have, in fact, made this a situation in which we're ruled by time. And going back from the ideas of 360 degrees, you can see these clocks, which were set up with cycles within cycles within cycles. So one of the other cycles is enormously important. What other major cycle from a heavenly body is important? Yes, to what? In fact, a lot of little clams go on a moon cycle, And if you take them away from the edge of the water, they retain that cycle within them. So they're absolutely based in moon cycles, because the tides come in and go out, of course. But it's different from that. We have times within us at different levels. And I've given you one of your references is, in fact, the neuroscience of times by Eagleman. Eagleman's a great guy. He's one of our better scientists. And he's very interested in time. So if any of you like neuroscience, you've got the reference there and you can look at it. But, as Philip said, what about aging? Do we have a clock within us that measures aging? Well, you can bet we do, because we all change as we age, so something is happening. And one of the major clocks is telomere shortening. Do you all know what a telomere is? Hey, wow, gathering new information. Well, you need to know what a telomere is because you are dependent on it, and your age is certainly dependent on it. Those are telomeres, those are chromosomes. And at the end of each... Oh, that's pretty. They sent me a new laser pointer, and they have these little pretty things at the end. There's a chromosome, and at the end there's this protective cap, and it's called a telomere. And as you age, you can see that you get telomere shortening. When you get to about that point, it's time for you to depart. Now, can you do anything about that? Well, the reason I'm bringing it up is, yes, you can. And Philip has already told you one thing, and that is, in fact, about your anxiety levels and pushing it. But I want to tell you about other things, and that is meditation. So I hope you will all, at some point, learn to meditate. It is actually very powerful. This is a nice paper. It comes from 2014, so it's modern. And what they did is they took 190 people from different groups. They analyzed their peripheral blood, and they looked at telomere activity in meditators and non-meditators. And, would you be surprised? Meditators had preserved telomeres more than people who didn't meditate. So if any of you are wondering if you should meditate, do it to keep young, because there's really good data to support it, if you want to keep young. What else can you do to keep young? Well, you want to take omega-3 fish oil. That's got a good reputation. Take exercise. How many of you exercise? It's not bad. There's some who don't. Keep it up. You're lengthening your life. You must meditate. And if you're a woman, providing your doctor agrees, hormone replacement has got a very good... very good effect as well. Okay, so now what I'd like to do is just talk about some of the cycles within us. And one of the cycles is, of course, a yearly cycle. Now, we don't see yearly cycles all that much, but if we were, of course, in Finland or somewhere up near the North Pole, we'd all know about the yearly cycles. But as a psychiatrist, of course, I know a lot about yearly cycles. And that's in cyclothymia, where you get periods of overactivity followed by periods of underactivity, under and over. And these just follow each other as night follows day. And there is, in fact, a perfectly good mechanism within the brain which, in fact, underpins these and structures them. Of course, there are triggers which can make it worse. So we have yearly cycles within us. But the ones which are most important for us are, in fact, circadian rhythms. They are enormously important. Circadian means about the time of the day, circa dia. So these are very important rhythms. And you can see that's midnight. and that's known. How many of you feel sleepy at 2 o'clock in the afternoon? Yep. Is that because you've had too large a lunch? No, it's part of your circadian rhythm. When you were growing up, when did puberty occur? During the day or during the night or both? Choose. Night. It's a night time. You secrete growth hormone at night. And this, in fact, is part of the cycles which lead to maturation. So, in fact, what goes on at different points in the day is very important. What about blood pressure? When is blood pressure highest and when is it lowest? It's highest, interestingly, in the morning, but you also get another rise in the evening too. So you get blood pressure cycles. You get other ones which are cycles of cortisol, and cortisol is one of the hormones which protects you against stress. When do most people die? What time of day? Early hours. Yeah, it's early hours of the morning. Why? Because your cortisol levels, which is a stress hormone, is down at that time. And so, in fact, you die when your cortisol levels are low. Well, that's one factor. It's an important factor, and that's why there are many deaths at night. So you have all these circadian rhythms going on within you. But there is, in fact, a very important rhythm which leads to sleep. Any of you know the hormone which leads to sleep? Yeah. Yes. Can you see it? Well done. Good. It's melatonin. And can you get melatonin in this country? No, exactly. Not over the counter. Can you get it over the counter in America? Yep. So if you want your melatonin, go to America. What does it do? It helps synchronize the sleep cycles with the time that you go to bed. And so you take it about 1 hour before you go to bed. You hope that that will, in fact, normalize your sleep cycles. So melatonin is one substance. So again, you can't just think of yourself as meeting each moment of the day fresh, which you can to some extent, of course, but you have to think of yourself as complex cycles within cycles and just watch it and see when you're at your best. Have you heard of owls and larks? Yes? Who's an... Okay, some of you haven't. A lark is somebody who gets up in the morning, bright, ready to go, life is fine, it's fantastic. I'm a lark. I love getting up in the morning, seeing the freshness and the dew and everything. If you're an owl... There are owls about. They don't like that. They don't come online till about 4 o'clock, and they go on till about 2 o'clock at night. Larks have had it by 10, believe you me. They do not want to go on. So probably a little late for you and I, but if you're getting a partner, the first thing you do is to find out if they're an owl or a lark, which is really important. Well, you could do. They'll probably get a bit bored with it. So then, what is it that hooks us on to the circadian cycle? Well, it's this. It is, in fact, the supraoptic nucleus. That's the optic chiasma, just to orientate you, front of brain, back of brain. And the supraoptic nucleus is just right here at the front. And it, in fact, gets light. And so light is one of the most important regulators of our sleep cycle. They're called Zeitgebers, because it was first described by a German. They're time givers. And light is a very important time giver for us, and that's the mechanism. And it really organizes all our sleep rhythms. But some of you may have heard the cave experiment, have you? What they did is they said, we will exclude all light and put you in a cave and bury you there, sort of. And if we do that, then we can see what your natural clock runs at. And they found, in fact, that the natural clock runs slow, so Zeitgeber comes in and starts it afresh each evening, or each morning, in fact. And then they did the experiment again. It's a very attractive experiment, that, and it happens to be wrong. In fact, we're now into the area of genes, and there's a gene called the PER gene, which is the gene which links you onto the time cycles. What would happen if you didn't have a functioning gene? Any ideas? There you are, no Zeitgeber. Well, your cycles run free, and what happens then? I've had several patients like that. And, yeah. Yes, because people are so horrid to you. When you come into work at 12 o'clock because your Zeitgeber hasn't been working very well and say, I'm sorry, I overslept. You didn't oversleep, you slept the right amount, but you started late because you didn't have a good Zeitgeber. Then people are horrid to you. Then you break down. But in fact, yes. Yep. Oh, I see. Okay. So it's a really interesting phenomenon. But in fact, the idea of the cave is not quite right. But you'll see that some genes put us just slightly short of the 24-hour cycle, and others put us slightly long. Okay, I want to talk about other cycles which are important for us. And these are sleep cycles. And we're going to do different states of consciousness. So just a little basic neurophysiology of dreams is good. Who doesn't dream? Okay. What I said is, who doesn't remember their dreams? Because this is the night cycle. And in fact, it's an old slide because it's got stage four there. This one's been removed from the international classification now. Awake, then you go down into sleep, one and two. You can get sort of dreams there. And then stage three, because four has been put into three. And then you come up for a period of dreaming sleep. And that is about a 90-minute cycle. So we have cycles within our sleep. Then you go down again, usually not quite as far, not quite as much, and a slightly longer period. And then towards the end of the night, you don't have any deep sleep at all. Now, the characteristics of these sleeps are all different. Do you remember I said puberty occurs at night? And that is because it occurs in stage three sleep, right at the beginning of the night. And so, of course, if you have people who have disturbed sleep, they don't get enough slow sleep, then you're putting out of function a whole lot of various cycles which you need. Now, this is just an interesting one for us, because do you remember that I was talking last fortnight, about whether we in fact have a good copy of the outside world or not. We saw that it was a construct, and in fact we don't. Well, you can ask yourselves an interesting question. You can ask, when you do something in your dreams, is it imaginary or is it real? Okay, imaginary or real? So, those of you who think it's imaginary, put your hands up. Three, four, five. A bit more, about half of you. And the others think it's real. Well, I'm going to get you to do an experiment now. So you'll all have to stand up. Oh, God, do we really have to stand up? Yes, you do. And look into, find a partner and look into their eyes. Okay. Now, this experiment we've done, we published a paper on it. And first of all, I want you to, one of you will lift a finger and hold it in front of you like that. Just one of you, one of the pair. Doesn't matter which one. Okay, now push the finger up so that you can see it. And now keep your head still and swing your finger like that and follow it with your eyes. Okay, you all got that. And the one who's watching tells me what you saw, what you see. Slow scanning movements, yes? His eyes are following his finger. Is that correct? Yes? Okay, now swap over and do it the other way around. So, okay? All right. Now, in order to be able to do that properly and track a finger, you require, first of all, information on the retina as to where the finger is. Then it goes back to the midbrain, which coordinates the eye muscles, and to the cerebellum as well. And so you're using many different reflex arcs to track the finger. Okay? Now, look into, go into your pairs again, and look into the other guy's eyes. Okay? This time, I want you not to hold up a real finger, but an imaginary finger. Okay? And then ask, move your imaginary finger and ask the other person what he sees. Do you understand? Yeah. Okay. So, she is going to follow her imaginary finger and you're going to look at her eyes. Okay.
So I follow my own imaginary finger.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. And now hold up an imaginary finger and now follow it as you move it and tell me what you see in her eyes.
Okay.
Exactly.
Yes.
They're little jerks, aren't they? Okay, did you get that?
Yes, we did it. What did you see?
I saw your eyes moving.
Oh, okay. No, you've got to be much better than that. That's all right. That's what you do is you look at
Jennifer.
Yes. And Jennifer is now going to hold up an imaginary finger.
Right.
Can you see your imaginary finger, Jennifer?
Yes.
Held it up.
Yes.
Now, do the experiment.
So push it from side to side,
and you watch her eyes while she does this. What do you notice?
Very jerky.
Aren't they? Aren't they?
Oh, but you move, so you have to move your eyes as you imagine your finger moving.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Yeah. Okay. All right, you can sit down again now. Now, the whole point of this was I asked you a question. I said, is a dream imaginary or is it real? And so, first of all, we saw what a real scanning eye movement looked like. And that's nice, simple pursuit movements. Uses a lot of brain activity to get it like that. Then I asked you to look at an imaginary finger. And those of you who did it, most of you, I think, got it, was that you do in what are called nystagmus. They're little jerks like that. So an imaginary finger is quite different from a real finger, okay? So now the question is, can you get somebody who's dreaming to move their eyes? Well, yes, you can. You can do somebody who's lucid dreaming. So they wake up in their dreams, and you tell them to do the experiment. Hold up a finger in front of your eyes. So they're going to hold up a real dream finger and follow it with your eyes. And then we'll be able to tell whether, in fact, it's imaginary whether it's real. What's the answer to that study? Are dream fingers imaginary or real? They're real. They use all that very complex neurophysiology when you're dreaming. We went on to look at other things, and a lot of people have done it since then. And that is, in fact, you can show that when you're dreaming, you are, in fact, using all the circuits you would use if you were awake. So dreams are very special. And one argument about dreams is that they're time for practice. Although there are many theories as to what dreams are, but that's one. So that's interesting. So although these are cycles within dreaming, and that the structure of dreams tells us that they're more than just imagination. So let's move on quickly now to brain and time, because we're nearly coming up to your coffee time. And you have a reference there. And I thought that it would be simplest if I just went through this very quickly with you, because you can look at it yourselves. And in fact, what we're looking at now is we're looking, first of all, at the prefrontal cortex up there. This is front, back. That's temporal lobe, frontal lobe. Manipulate time information for working memory. So that's important. So that's where you can make time. You put it into working memory, so you try to keep a track of what time is. Superior and middle temporal cortex, that's all down there. You retrieve and compare duration. And of course, if you have a disorder of that structure, then you get things like jamais vu and déjà vu. Déjà vu, of course, is you've seen it all before, same time, same everything. Jamais vu, you never have. Parietal cortex controls attention. It's up there. The cerebellum is most interesting. Cerebellum is one of the most sensitive mechanisms we have for recording time. And in fact, it looks to see whether two stimuli which come in fact coincident with each other or not. Then the premotor cortex, parietal cortex, and cerebellum, that's that. Premotor cortex is up there, parietal cortex. For timing predictions, which is what they're saying about cerebellum. Supplementary motor area, which is that area there, helps estimate how expectation changes over time. And then the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex updates expectations if time prediction is wrong. So again, there's the front, and it's updating your decisions about what time should be like. I hope by now you're getting the feeling that time is a construct. Doesn't actually exist, it's a construct. Just like, do you remember your visual world, which you all thought was so solid? It's not, as we were able to show you. Prediction is pretty good, but it's only a prediction. And time is exactly the same, it's another one. And so it's not going to surprise you that time, in fact, can stretch out, as Philip was saying, if you're in an accident, you can. Time will go very slowly, so it's stretching out and out. And of course, it can go extremely quickly so that you can see things which seem to last eternity. And these are altered states of consciousness, which we will do next time. But time is one of the main things about it. And you'll learn as you slowly come to understand yourselves that you can, in fact, go deep into yourselves, into a part of you, where time becomes much more universal, and you leave sort of clock time. Clock time is just an artifact. We've seen that. It just happens to be 24 hours because we've got the sun that does that. And the brain also synthesizes time. So I'm just going to do one more experiment, and then you can go and have some coffee, and then Martin will take over. just to show you that in actual fact, even our modern science thinks that time is a very variable quantity and the brain can see into the future. Now, there was the most almighty row about this last year on a paper published by a guy called Bem, and it's called Presentiment, Presentience. And so I'll just show you that. Do you all know what the galvanic skin response is? Okay, you guys are really learning today, aren't you? You know that you have sensitive areas in you which sweat, particularly. You know that your hands sweat. That if you shake somebody's hand and it's dripping, you know they're totally anxious or it's cold. Okay, so you've got these areas which respond to the autonomic stimulus. So you can put electrodes on and measure it. This is the basis of the lie test, because there on his hand are in fact electrodes. And if he gets anxious, he'll sweat. That'll change the resistance. And it comes out, oh, look, they're modern on a computer. Okay? So if you got the principle, very simple principle, if you are emotionally aroused, you will sweat and you can pick it up, and it's actually very sensitive. And if you're doing that sort of experiment, and we've done quite a lot of these, you have the electrodes on the fingers. It's actually one on each set of fingers, but we don't usually do that. I put one there and then one on the non-sweaty bit up there. And then you can measure it. Now, if I had those electrodes on and I did that, most of you would have been startled, and that would have produced a little bit of sweat, and so I would have been able to see that on the deviation of the pen recorder. And so we can do this in a more formal way. We can, for the moment, don't worry about heart rate and things like that. Just look at this one, which is the one I've been talking about. At this point, where this line is, they're shown a slide, and then their response to the slide then occurs like that. Okay? Nasty slide, sweat a lot, and then the effect goes off. Got the principle? Yeah? Okay, so it's done in the lab. Why they do that, I don't know. But at any rate, there's a television set there. And pictures come on it. Oh, look at that. Isn't that beautiful? Relax, you guys. Oh, yes, no sweating. Yep. Let me show you that one. Lots of sweating. Somebody hanging like that. That's not nice. It's an emotional one, isn't it? So when you see that, you'll sweat just a little bit. Don't like it. Okay. And now we come to the experiment itself. This is a period before the experiment, 7.5 seconds before the experiment. Now, you have to understand something here, or it makes no sense. And that is that the computer chooses the slide here at time zero. So the slide isn't even chosen there. It's just not chosen. And then there is the response that you make, and then again it dies away and you come into the next trial. Okay? You got that. And remember, the slide is not chosen until this point. So all this time before, neither you nor the computer knows what slide it's going to present. And then here are some sequences. They're all random. The computer chooses random emotional slides or calm slides in various orders. And then here's your result. As you can see, the slide is chosen here and exposed. And emotional slides, you get a big response to. These ones are, if I could read it, which I can't. It's emotional and sexual and sort of karmish slides, okay? So it works nicely, doesn't it? The emotional slides produce a big response, the calm ones a small response, and the sexual ones an intermediate response. Okay, well, we can go home. No, we can't, because you guys should be interested in that. Because here we come along, remember the slide hasn't been chosen, and then it is chosen at that point, but here it hasn't been, but something funny is happening. It looks as if the brain knows what's going to happen. Do you see? Knows it's going to have an emotional slide, or it's going to have a sexual slide or a tranquil slide. And you can tell which photo is coming next if you look at this. And so there is the calm one, there is the emotional one. The emotional one is much higher, but you can say, okay, let's get the baseline so that they're the same. And then this is what you find. You can find that there is a clear difference between the emotional slide and the ordinary one. Now, that is a staggering result. Now, this is another way of doing it, and this is yet another way of doing it. So, in fact, 3 seconds before, the brain knows what it's going to get, although this hasn't been chosen. Now, this should tell you straight away that there is something very strange about time and our understanding of time, and much more than that, our understanding of the world. So what I want you to think about is that we then come on to all these descriptions of an alteration of time. I think it was Gibson, somebody will remind me if I'm wrong. He was Ed Vice Chief Marshal Gibson. He was flying in Scotland when he was a lieutenant pilot, newly qualified. He looked out and he saw, this was in the 1920s, he saw mono-wing planes of a different colour all on the ground, and he thought, my God, people are doing something there. And he reported it in his log, and he went up before the station commander, who said, what's this? And he told him the story. The station commander said, don't put that in your log or you will change your career. So he took it out of his log. But the interesting point about this story was that 10 years later, when he was flying up the same point of Scotland, what he was looking at previously were Spitfires, which he now saw on the ground with mono-wing aircraft. So time again is something which is another construct for us. And so when we come on to the latter part of this course, you'll have learned that vision is in fact a construct. You'll have learned that time is a construct. In fact, this whole world is a construct, mainly. So you're asking the question you all did. Remember you did the question, who am I? Well, we're now going to say, what happens when we dig right down into the basis of not only our nature, but into what goes on this planet? And just to end with, really, this is the past. I put it in red for you guys. No, you're not to. Future, gave it a slightly brighter color. No, you are not to. You're to be only in one place. Now, if you all read The Power of Now, who has not read The Power of Now? Okay, guys, straight off to Amazon, get The Power of Now and read it, Eckhart Tolle. And don't you agree that it's a very nice indication of what happens if you can stay in that area? Your world is very different, so do your homework and practice it. Practice, practice, practice. Okay? Looks to me as if it's coffee time. Okay. We'll see you back here in 20 minutes.